The Republicans have no one out there that can touch this guy. So for this moment, this election, this primary is the presidential. And that, Ida, is the State of the Union. And on that note, I'm gonna take a shit.
This isn't playtime. This is serious business.
Well, the play must go on, I believe.
I'm always home, I'm on cool.
I've been thinking a lot about dying lately.
I'm trying to do good. That's that.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of That's That, a Philip Seymour Hoffman retrospective podcast. My name is Timothy Mark Davis, and I'm your host. Today, we are talking about The Ides of March, the 2011 political thriller directed and co-written by George Clooney and starring Ryan Gosling, George Clooney, Paul Giamatti, Evan Rachel Wood, Marissa Tomei, Jeffrey Wright, and of course, Philip Seymour Hoffman. I hope you took the time to watch the film on Prime because it kicks off a bit of what I would call a kind of Hollywood era for Phil. Who on earth makes a movie with George Clooney and Brad Pitt in the same year? Not me, that's for sure. My guest today is friend and politics enthusiast Tim McDermott. Tim, how are you today?
I'm doing fine.
Today we're talking about The Ides of March, which features Philip Seymour Hoffman as Paul Zara? How do you think it's pronounced? Do they say in the film?
I like to think that it's Zara, and that after he left the campaign, he went on to found the fast fashion retail chain Zara.
Nice. So Paul Zara, the shrewd and smoking presidential campaign manager to presidential hopeful Mike Morris, played by George Clooney, and boss of campaign staffer Stephen Myers. Ryan Gosling, played by Ryan Gosling. Can you believe, just really quick before I go on with the scripted section, the names in this movie? Stephen Myers, Mike Morris, Tom Duffy. I mean,
it's funny you bring this up because just before this, as I was sitting here waiting, I was thinking, oh, really subtle having a woman named Ida Horowitz as a beat writer for the New York Times.
Unbelievable.
Like, I mean, geez.
It's a little on the nose, George.
Yeah.
Like these boring ass white guy names and then the Jewish named reporter with the New York. It's.
I have to speak to my editor, Abraham Heschel, and he can tell me if I can release the story.
You may be familiar with him. Christ. He wrote Sabbath.
And maybe it gets into the point of the movie, which is the. Naming it the Ides of March, first of all.
Right, right.
It's obviously, I'm not sure I know the right term for it, but it's not satire. It's the like dramatic form of satire.
Like, yeah, like social like where, commentary.
Yeah, it's almost a morality play
Where
the specifics are unimportant.
Right.
The specifics of like all of what we'll get into with the baby and whatnot are really unimportant. It's this larger like social thing,
exactly.
This morality play idea.
Yeah, it's like not as interesting or funny as satire, but not as boring as social commentary. It's a little between the two. There's probably a name for it. I can't think of it right now. But before we get into all that, we have to talk about the log line. So here's the log line from IMDb.
Christ.
An idealistic staffer for a new presidential candidate gets a crash course on dirty politics during his stint on the campaign trail. Exactly. Here is the log line from Amazon Prime.
I'm doing that because you're reading a log line.
I know.
Oh my God.
Come on. You got it. You're just like John. You got to do the log line section. That is part
you
of
should,
the podcast.
Seriously, I meant it when I said you should do an entire log line podcast. It would be incredibly boring. It would be just unbelievably, like, I don't know what the word is for like a group. Oh, it's navel gazing. It would just be, you and the four other people who care about this topic just being like, oh, what a good log line.
What I wanted to happen has begun to happen where I assess these log lines, but really it becomes this meta thing about assessing log lines.
You know, and this is funny. This is a very exact same thing I do as a joke with the captioners that they have on Hulu and Amazon videos, and I will watch it, and it will be like at the end, caption match captions brought to you by Catherine. I'm like, That Catherine, man, she is damn good. Never misses a beat. But I do it as a joke, right? And you, for
I'm
some
serious.
Reason, yeah. are you? I'm surprised you don't know the names of logline writers.
I honestly want to get into it. I feel like if all else fails, which it probably will, I'll have 55 episodes where I assess loglines and I can go to the logline people and say, will you just hire me, please? Look how much I've thought about this. Against all odds, against my friends saying, will you shut up about it? So speaking of not shutting up about it,
Amazon.
The logline from Amazon Prime. During a brutal presidential primary season, an idealistic campaign staffer, Ryan Gosling, discovers a secret that could alter the race for his candidate, George Clooney.
I would like to know what makes Ryan Gosling an idealistic. This is a Sorkinism, okay? This is a Sorkinism where they tell you something is true, and therefore it is established as truth. So Sorkin does this when in The West Wing, when he writes a really good speech. He lets you know it was a really good speech by A, making the audience like rapturously applaud, interrupting the speech with rapturous applause.
Yeah.
And every time he does it, after the speech, a character will come up to someone and be like, that is the greatest speech I've ever heard.
Yes.
What demon wrote that? You freak, you loser.
And then
how could
emotional
you?
Intro music begins.
Yes. And so,
or outro.
So this is what I think of the idealistic thing. It's because at the beginning of the movie, anything I call her is going to be perceived as anti-Semitic.
Yeah. Just call her Ida.
Melissa Tomei's character.
Marissa Tomei.
Whatever. I'm going to give.
That was anti-Italian of you.
I'm going to give Maxine Tomei's character a new name, and it's Melissa Tomei. Mystique Misty Tomei.
Yes, Misty Toes.
She says at the beginning, like, oh, he's... You believe all this crap, don't you? But like, you know, there's nothing to suggest any sort of ideal. There's no idealism presented.
It's not too strong.
Did I miss it?
I think it's there are moments of it, but it might actually be a strength of the film where they don't try to puff up Ryan Gosling's character in this sort of West Wingian, idealistic,
yeah.
non-existent, fantastical political world. They just give him a sense of like, he's 30. He's got a little bit of dirt under his fingernails. He's not completely jaded yet, like Giamatti and Hoffman.
Yeah.
His characters are. He's just got these moments. And we get that in the Giamatti scene where he's like, this is the shit the Republicans pull. You know, he's trying to grasp at some sort of ideals, but it is not overt at all. And Ryan Gosling's kind of not an idealistic looking or sounding person. He's not like an inspiring
figure. He's my ideal.
Well, he is a beautiful man. That is for sure.
Well, we'll talk about the Republicans thing.
Yes, we'll get into the Republicans later. So I've got some more. So for today's factoid dump, I'd like to get your reaction and opinion on some of these as I go through them. So if you let me know if you care or you don't care. If that's just like a, I don't care and we move on, or if you want to add a pithy comment or two, that would be great. Sound good to you?
Uh-huh.
All right, let's begin. So as mentioned, The Ides of March was directed and co-written by George Clooney, who is too famous to bother naming any of his credits. The other co-writer on the project is Grant Heslov, who is a longtime producing and writing partner of Clooney's, which I came to learn up this film. The film had a third co-writer in Bo Willimon, who wrote the play that this film is based on and who you may know as the creator, showrunner, and a head writer for a little series called House of Cards.
Of course, yeah. What was the other writer's credits?
Grant Heslov.
He did
Monuments Men with Clooney.
Oh, Christ.
He did... What's the other Clooney one?
Well, so that sort of goes to show, I'm glad you named those like too, especially with the House of Cards thing, because yes. I think a lot of the writing is incredibly ham-fisted. And we've never talked about this, but this is something I read where people have a beef with All My Sons and Incident at Vichy because they think it's just like sort of ham-fisted moralizing. And he just is giving these characters these long speeches to make as moral examples, right?
Right,
you've heard this.
Right. Yeah. Well, we all do it, so.
We all do it,
we're
sure.
All pretty ham-fisted, let's be honest.
So now that I know that this is a House of Cards prequel, yes. Essentially, it makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, it does make a lot of sense. It's like House of Cards light. It was like proof that something with, I would say, minor political sensibilities
yeah.
could play for a larger audience. And then it's like, okay, let's ratchet up the deception, the deceit, the murder, and
yeah.
the psychopath that is Kevin Spacey.
Well, yeah,
on
I was
and
gonna
off the
say,
screen.
This is, you know, House of Cards light in every way, including that it, as far as we know, did not have a serial sexual predator at its helm.
As far as we know.
And yes, we don't actually know if this show had any connections to Jeffrey Epstein, whereas House of Cards, we know of several Epstein connections on that cast.
Oh my god, 10 minutes in and we got to Epstein. That's a little late in my opinion, but that's okay. I'm glad
I mean, it's a politics movie.
It's true, yeah, it was only a matter of time. But I honestly thought we'd get there sooner, knowing your, I'm not going to out you just yet. We'll get to 9/11 later. So the film has an 84% on Rotten Tomatoes, if that means something to anyone. It had a budget of $12.5 million, which means you would need to make 14 Ides of Marches to equal the budget of Mission Impossible Fallout, an astoundingly great movie. I know you agree with me, Tim.
I don't know what the point of that comparison is.
There's, oh God bless you. Oh, COVID-19. Jeez. The point of that comparison is to... Yeah, exactly. The point of that of those comparisons
you
is
can,
to basically
you can
say...
Edit stuff out. You can edit stuff out, right?
I can, but I won't. No, I will okay. some. But not you saying COVID 420. Definitely not. That's
no,
going to be the lead-in.
Good. You should edit my last name out. I'm not kidding. Can you take my last name out?
Why?
Please?
Why?
Can you do it for me?
Is it because of Epstein?
No, I just want to, if I know that I'm just, you know, Tim, I can be a lot more free with what I want to say.
Can you be Tim M or Tim?
No, not the last one. I can be Tim M.
Tim M.
I'm not. Right. I'm serious. You got to take my last name out.
You think I'm playing? You don't think I'll do it?
Wait, no. Hold on. I interrupted you because yes. I want to know what the point of the comparison you
oh,
make with the budget, because you do
it
every time.
So the budget comparison is: look at what this kind of indie movie can do on this amount of money that then these other massive movies need all this money to get people to the theater. Give me a break. But it's also a critique on myself for even making that comparison, because sometimes those huge budget movies are phenomenal, like Mission Impossible Fallout.
Yeah. But there's no like halo jumping or explosions in Ides of March. So of course it costs less than.
I know. I just like to put things in financial perspective, you know?
All right.
The log line is marketing perspective for Joe. Joe's our friend who's a marketing guru, apparently. No comment
yeah.
from Tim. No comment.
I thought that you were going to keep going.
I was just seeing if you would take the bait at all, which you didn't, which is good. Joe won't listen to this anyway, so it doesn't matter. So, as I was saying, the film was released just a few months after it was shot, which was a crazy fast turnaround from production to release. A film being shot in a year and then released that same year, that is pretty rare, pretty strange. It was shot predominantly in and around Cincinnati, Ohio, where George Clooney grew up, with a handful of scenes in Michigan and Kentucky. Tim, you're from Ohio, yes? Which part of Ohio?
The Northeast.
That is vague. Do you like Ohio?
It has charm.
Yeah.
And I appreciate every place I've lived, including, you know, the terrible places in Indiana.
Sure.
And New Jersey.
Indiana's beautiful.
I try and take terrible in the like backwaterness of them.
Of course, sure.
I try and find something I, you know, like and value about each place that I've lived. And, you know, I do like and value Ohio. We get four seasons, we get snow, we get beautiful changing leaves and lovely fall. Yeah, I voted in 2012 there, but that was the only time I ever voted there. So
you get LeBron James and then you don't get him, and then you get him, and then you don't get him.
Yeah, well, you know, let's not get too sidetracked, but he is such a whiny bitch. Oh my God. Like after now every interview I've seen post game, whatever.
He just wants his respect, Tim.
He just keeps saying that. Like, what the fuck are you talking about? What are you even talking about, dude?
I think he's talking about the fact that people like us are texting and being like, is he better than Jordan or
honestly,
not?
Honestly, he's on Twitter and he's name searching himself and he's like sees these tweets and he thinks that like he listens to Stephen A. Smith. And it fucking blows my mind the levels of persecution. Like, you think I have this, you know, insane conspiratorial persecution complex, but mine is based in facts and reality. This is a multimillionaire superstar athlete, commonly regarded as the greatest at his a greatest athlete in the world, complaining because people are mean to him online. The hell are we doing?
I don't know.
You know what? Yeah. Michael Jordan doesn't complain about people being mean to him online. You know why?
Because
Michael Jordan drinks a barrel of whiskey every single day.
Michael Jordan soaks his eyeballs in that whiskey
night
when he goes to bed.
Those eyes, and it sets off against his teeth, which are just brilliant white.
I know.
And his eyes look like a crocodile that you'd caught in a flashlight in a Florida swamp.
It's so true. Oh, it
is
so true.
Back to the useless facts.
Yes, yes. A few other notable facts and pieces of trivia that I found interesting. Leonardo DiCaprio was originally in the Ryan Gosling role.
I am so... Oh my God. I'm sorry. How many roles was quote-unquote Leonardo DiCaprio in the front runner spot?
Boogie Nights.
Every movie ever says Leo DiCaprio was in the running. Gone with the Wind, we found a notable fact that Leo DiCaprio was originally
the fetus of Leonardo DiCaprio.
Like, it's every movie says that Leo DiCaprio was the first in line to play the role. I cannot tell you. God, I wish Leo DiCaprio would be Leo decapitated.
Well, you know what else came out that year that was a decapitation of sorts? J. Edgar. So just remember that he might have not done Ides of March in order to do J. Edgar, which is one of the worst movies of the 21st century. If you ask me.
I would like to probe that a little bit.
Have you seen J. Edgar?
Yeah, I have, and it's bad. It's terrible.
Okay, it's terrible.
So you said one of the worst movies.
He also did Django Unchained that year, which is overwrought. I'm sorry, it is.
Get
Django an editor, Quentin.
It's a terrible movie. absolutely awful. I mean, I don't know if. So I have okay. So we'll talk about Quentin later, but.
Maybe.
Let's not even go into the
we'll press forward. So
movies.
So Leonardo did stay on as an executive producer, which I don't know why, whatever. Here's another one for you. Brad Pitt was originally cast as Paul Zara, Phil's role. Can you imagine? Like, I need someone out there to make a deep fake of that for me right now, please. All right, no comment from you. Perfect. It received an Oscar nomination for Best Writing of an Adapted Screenplay. It was the only Best Motion Picture Drama Golden Globe nominee, that was not nominated for a Best Picture Oscar. Sorry, George Clooney. As for the title, you may or may not know, The Ides of March, which is March 15th, was the day that Julius Caesar was assassinated. In Shakespeare's Julius Caesar, before being stabbed to death, Caesar is told by a soothsayer, beware the Ides of March. But the reason why we're here is that this is Philip Seymour Hoffman's 45th feature film, where he plays, again, the shrewd, smoking, and loyalty-obsessed campaign manager, Paul Zara.
This is some kind of fucking practical, I mean. My fucking blood pressure's going through the goddamn roof right now.
Paul, I'm sorry. Leave me. I just didn't think it was
true. It doesn't matter what you fucking thought. It matters what you did. It matters what you didn't do.
What?
Because if all this shit is true, I made a fucking ass out of myself in Thompson's place, and I gave away our game plan.
What are your overall thoughts, feelings, and impressions of the film as a whole?
That's interesting. For the most part, I think it's good.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's interesting. I think it's too long. And I think there's several scenes that are really just too long as well. Like, they are themselves too long. I think the movie should end as Phil is walking away in the funeral.
Mm.
He's walking from away from, yes. He's got this, you know, only Phil could deliver the line this way. As he's walking away from Gosling at the funeral, he says, you know, no one there to screw you over. And Gosling says, must be nice. And he, you know, as he's walking away, just barely turns his head and just says, sounds like it will be or something. You know, I don't, but he just sort of tosses this line to the ground.
Yeah.
But it's perfectly delivered, and it, you know, there's this really nice shot that pans out and all that, and that should really be the end of the movie.
What do they do? The last scene with the speech thing, right?
Well, kind they
like
go
confirming
to
confirming Gosling's demise into being a dirty political operative.
Yeah, they go to, you know, Jeffrey Wright's character endorsing and him collecting the delegates,
right,
and then
right,
they
right,
go
right.
to the new intern. Everyone's going to screw. Walking
right.
up, you know,
yeah.
and then,
yeah.
and then the final scene is him. Well, I guess the only important thing you get here, I think, in the end of this movie is with him and the reporter in the hall, where he gets
right.
his, like, we get that little neat friendship bullshit finally tied up in a bow.
Yeah, that's true.
You're my best friend, Ida, which he finally understands that, like, he gets
he
it.
He has no friends.
Yeah, there are no friends. Like he,
there are no friends.
You know, he realizes that now.
Yeah.
And so that's the only important thing I think we get from beyond the
sure.
The funeral. But that's just me. And then, so, like, the scene where he confronts Clooney in the kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
It feels like it's 10 minutes long. It probably isn't.
It
feels
long.
And it's twice as long as it needs to be, because they do this constant, like, back and forth, like we're watching a police interrogation sort of thing, but very
mm-hmm.
boring. The stakes are fairly low, honestly, because it's like, I guess the stakes are really high, but they don't do a very good job of showing you how high the stakes are. So it just
well,
feels
kind of
like
speak in code for a lot of it. Which, yeah, it's like trying very hard to be good writing, which I actually think the writing on this film is pretty decent. It's like political thriller light is what I kind of felt. It's like it's not a very difficult film to understand by any means, which is fine, you know. But sometimes I think it made me feel like they were simplifying things that are actually extremely complex, which I know you have to do in a movie. And we've even talked about this on other episodes where it's like, you have to narrow things down. You have to simplify them. You can't be really true to life because then it would just be boring and not great cinema. But yeah, I don't know. It's kind of, the film kind of, obviously it depressed me. You know, I left it feeling like, but it depressed me, but it also felt completely irrelevant to this moment in time. You know, like maybe in 2011, it was like, ooh, the underbelly of politics. But in 2020, it was just like soft serve. I don't know. It was like, well, duh. Like this, this has no impact right now because we're way beyond our sensitivity and our knowledge of these types of doings.
Yeah.
Would you agree? Would you disagree? Do you understand what I'm, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. I mean, I don't think that this should have been news to anyone in 2011. You know, yeah. There are plenty of the Ted Kennedy murdered a, you know, prostitute and with his, you know, drove his car off a bridge and left her to drown. And, you know,
right.
Obviously Bill Clinton and everything he's done and arranged. So like the idea that a politician would like, none of this would have surprised me then either.
Right.
I guess I didn't feel anything.
I think it's less about the affair part. And it's more about Gosling's character, like really compromising what he set out to do in order to win. You know, really compromising and getting down. And it kind of goes to the Giamatti clip.
No, none of this is about the democratic process, Steve. It's about getting your guy.
This is the kind of shit the Republicans pull.
Yeah, you know what? This is the kind of shit that the Republicans pull, and it's about time we learned from them. They're meaner, they're tougher, they're more disciplined than we are. I've been in this business 25 years, and I've seen way too many Democrats bite the dust because they wouldn't get down the mud with the fucking elephants.
So Giamatti on getting down
I
in the mud with the elephants.
I hate what, that speech.
Why do you hate that clip? Why do you hate that clip? You complain about Democrats being soft all the time. But
yeah,
also,
but
isn't that the better thing, right?
What?
Like, is politics, are we all just supposed to, like, get down in the mud? Let's go back. Why do you hate that clip?
It is taking a political point, like, that is out there, that is well trodden, right? Mm-hmm. Everyone talks about this, and then putting it in the mouth of an actor to... I mean, I don't know what I'm getting at other than like, it's lazy. It's like doing a movie and, you know, you're just like taking this already developed idea and this already developed phrase and this already developed political point, and then you're just like tossing it in someone's mouth and it's sort of given this edge of profundity as a result.
Well, and that's where I would say, for just speaking for me personally, just where I was in life the first time I saw this film, and it's probably different for you because you were much more politically engaged 9-10 years ago than I was, but it rings hollow to me today, but back then it felt more edgy or like, oh wow, yeah, Republicans are better at
I guess
playing dirty. Democrats are always trying to, like, you know, go high. They go low, we go high, you know, which tends to make them lose. But also, isn't that what we want? We want, like, integrity.
It's not even about, like, Democrats going high. It's about Democrats not even showing up at all for anything. And it gets to, I don't want, no, let's not do this.
Tim, this is the politics podcast now. This is why you're here. You're here to do
but,
this.
Like, we're supposed to be talking about the movie, not about the like politics of the current moment.
I know, and we'll get there on our own. So let's listen to what George Clooney had to say about Philip Seymour Hoffman.
He was such a great actor. He's so instinctive. You know, directing him was, you know, directing him was picking and choosing. It wasn't, you know, let me tell you what you should do. It was literally going, you turn him loose and he'll do. He would do, what was so interesting about him is he would give you sort of three choices and I would do three takes with him. Literally every scene we did three takes, and the first take would be very quiet and very calm, and then the second take would be just raging, you know, eyes screaming, spitting, yelling, and then he'd do one in between. And it was so much fun because he gave you options, which doesn't often always happen with actors. A lot of times they've decided on something and they're going to do that. And he was always experimenting and always looking to say, well, let me go push this a little bit, and then let me stay completely out of that one. And I found him to be You know, to work with he and Paul Giamatti at the same time was so much fun, to have two actors that I have such great respect for on either side of each other, kind of eyeballing one another. It was really fun, fun to do.
And you could enjoy that process, that he could as well, that you could laugh at yourself, because he was not only intent, he got into the character he was playing.
But he wasn't, it wasn't sort of manic. There was a, you know, when you said cut, you could, we'd all go have dinner, and it was easy and fun, and he was never a, I think he was very happy at that period of time in his life. He seemed to be.
So this, I loved, the thing I loved about this clip was just very simply this idea that he would give three takes, like the lower one, the big one, and then something in between. And it was funny watching the film. I think I watched this clip before I saw the film, and I was kind of looking for, okay, I wonder which one this was. I wonder which one this was. And I never thought about that as an approach to acting before, at least for the camera, where it's like, you know, just give three. Obviously, giving distinct takes is something that I'm familiar with, but the idea that they're just like emotionally regulated in three different spots, like at a very basic, like here's one that's screaming and yelling, here's a really quiet and subtle one, and here's one that's in between. But it is kind of genius, because you're giving the other actor stuff, you're giving the director a sense of like, oh, this is what I like better, and then ultimately you're giving an editor options to work with to paste something together. But what do you think of the Phil performance in this movie, Tim? In context of the Hoffman canon?
I don't know. I mean, it's not his best movie, but it's like it's certainly a fine performance. You know, that you would expect from him.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that he has some really good moments, and I, you know, there's just things that I think I love watching Phil do when he's doing the loyalty speech, which I know we're gonna play.
Mm-hmm.
He's like got his unlit cigarette in one hand and his lighter in the other hand. And as he's telling the story, he's doing, and it's a very like real, you know, they're very small, natural hand props that he uses. Or when he's getting fired, the thing that I noticed that he does that I've never really seen anyone do, you know, he walks out and he lights a cigarette, and you know, you could tell the man smokes because he does it all the correct way, right? You know. Yep. It's very clear that Phil is used to walking out of, you know, onto a busy street and lighting a cigarette. Yes. That is a very natural thing.
Mm-hmm.
But what he does is he walks over there, and Clooney calls him into the car, and he sets the cigarette down on a drain pipe.
Oh my gosh.
Rather than throw it away.
Yeah.
Which is what I think, you know, you're every actor.
Movies do that all the time. Yeah. They throw away full cigarettes. Ugh.
Yeah. All the time. People just light it, take a puff and throw it.
And
Phil does like what a real smoker would do. And that he's like, hold on.
Metal.
This is, yeah, like, I have plenty more of these, but I just lit this one. Like, here's a nice drain pipe. And he also does this thing where he's like, can you hop and talk for a second? And he says, yeah, a guy rolls the window up, and he, like, turns and takes a big hit, right? And then he sets it down on the drain pipe very nicely, and he sets it down exactly the way, you know, that, and then he goes in the car and he gets fired, obviously, which I really love the shot of that scene and the way it's
done.
Yeah,
I do too. I love that they just don't show it, just the car.
Yeah, there's a couple shots I didn't think in this movie that are done really well.
I agree.
Really
the flag silhouettes, I really like.
Yeah, that's always a nice jerk off one.
Yes,
I like
what you didn't do. Like silhouettes. Yeah.
I like the silent wide shot of them in the classroom, the three of them in chairs knee to knee.
Yep. That's a great shot.
That's a great shot. And that's a shot that honestly, if they hadn't gone into the description, you know, like they go in, they take that shot then in and they have the actual conversation. That's a point where I actually think it would have been better is like that wide shot that holds for a sort of eerily, uncomfortably long period of time and then cuts immediately to the next scene without telling you what the conversation is. We know what the conversation is.
Yeah.
Or we're going to get that information later. So, I don't know. That's just a thought. I like that. One of my favorite movies, Contagion, does that a lot. It's a great movie, dude. Soderbergh lights it.
Yeah, up. It is a great movie.
Soderbergh really knows what he's doing. Mm-hmm. And so they do this great thing where they hold shots a lot of times for periods of time that, you know, feel uncomfortable, and there's no audio, or the audio is some sort of soundtrack. Anyway, so he gets in the car and they have that great shot, and then he gets back out, and as the cars are rolling away, you see him look for the cigarette, but you notice it's not there anymore. If you look closely. And so like he's gotten out to this destitute news, and now he's just standing there, and you see him sort of looking down at the drain pipe for several seconds. You know, this sort of, it's very easy for him to just like reach in his pocket and relight a cigarette, right? But he's set this one aside. It was preserved. And it's just another insult that has hit him, right? It's another dejection, you know. Right. So
yeah, I mean, I think that whole sequence really points to something that Phil was so good at, which was making extremely specific choices that don't seem like it's an actor making an interesting choice. You know, like somehow he could integrate a choice like setting it down on the drain pipe and, you know, turning back for one last hit, coming out and looking for it. And it doesn't feel like an actor trying to be actory, which I think a lot of actors fall into. It feels totally integrated into the character, into the performance, which I think is like one of his superpowers. It's why playing the diversity of characters that he did and being able to play them believably and distinctly, each having these colors of specific choices and details, but still feeling true to the character, true to the story of the film. He makes it look easy, but it's just not easy to be that in it and that specific and maintaining integrity with the story at the same time.
I made a mistake. I made a stupid...
No.
Mistake.
No, Stephen, you didn't make a mistake. You made a choice. You called me and left a message to call you back that it was important. And when I did, you told me to forget about it. You chose not to tell me. Why'd you make that choice?
Because, Paul, I didn't think it was important.
Oh, fuck yes, you did. But you went because you were curious, because you felt flattered, because you felt special. To think that Duffy wanted to speak to you instead of me? Because you thought to yourself, maybe I can get something out of this because it made you feel big? You know, the first campaign I ran is a tiny little race in Kentucky. State Senate seat, you know, working for some redneck nobody named Sam McGuthrie. No staff, no money, no fucking office. Everyone thought we didn't stand a chance. No way we can compete, right? And about this time, this guy running this congressional campaign a few districts over gives me a call. And he says, I really like what you're able to do for poor old Sam. But let's face it, he's a goner. Why don't you come work for me? What did I do? Well, Stephen, this is where you and I are different. I told Sam about the call. And Sam says to me, Paul, if you think this other guy's got a chance at winning and he can pay you more than anything I can afford, and if it's what you feel you need to do, then I won't get in your way. And I say, Sam, you took a chance on me and hired me when I was even more of a nobody than you are. So I'd be damned if I'm going to jump ship just because the shit hits the fan.
We lost that race, but 3 years later when Sam decided to run for governor, who do you think he called? We won that race, and 20 years later I am where I am fucking now. Now, there's only one thing I value in this world, Stephen, and that's loyalty.
And without it, you are nothing. And you have no one. And in politics, in fucking politics, it's the only currency you can count on. That's why I'm letting you go. Not because you're not good enough, not because I don't like you, but I value trust over skill, and I don't fucking trust you anymore.
Oh.
All right, two things is
yeah.
No one on earth tells a story like Philip Seymour Hoffman.
Oh, it's so true.
No one, I mean, just the cadence, the rhythm, the emphasis. I really like what you're able to do for poor old Sam, you know, and he just, the emphasis, because he puts the emphasis there and he slows it down. And in that, you know exactly what he is getting across.
Yep. The subtext is so alive.
He doesn't have to sit there and explain that this guy called and said, I love what you're doing for poor old Sam, and then say he thought Sam was an idiot or whatever. You know, like, it's all right there. It's all pregnant, as they say.
Yeah.
And then the second thing is that no one, absolutely no one on earth says the F word like Seymour Hoffman.
No.
You know, he smokes better than everyone. He drinks better than everyone. He says the F word better than everyone. I mean, just the way he says it. And he's like,
he never sounds false when he says it.
Yeah.
It always sounds true.
In the story, what is it? Where does he say it? It's like, oh, he says we had no money, no staff, no fucking office. And it just hits perfectly. Right. Yep. He just nails it. He makes it flow. And, but the way he tells the story, man, it's remarkable.
Yeah, it's
just
great.
Everything is so in there, and he knows when to speed it up and he knows when to slow it down.
Yeah, I love the bit in there, and it might have even been a mistake where he was like about to say the wrong line, but he's like, I was when Ryan Gosling is protesting too much. I forget what he's saying exactly. And Phil is like, oh, fuck yes, you do. Like, he's about to say, oh, shut up or something. And he says,
oh, fuck yes, you did.
And it, like, turns into the F word. It's like, what? How did you do that? How did you do
and
that?
And I mean, really, in the scene, too, he just, he really knows, you know, this is Phil at his best, which is sort of telling a story and giving a speech.
Yeah.
This is where, you know, in Moneyball, he really shines, is he's like facing down Brad Pitt in the, you know, in the locker room, and he's giving these like little mini speeches that are beautiful. And just, it's really, you know, he does so much in every scene, but it's really where he gets a chance to speechify and tell you a little story that I think
he's
shines.
Working with text. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you know, you look at, Mission Impossible 3.
Oh.
You know, that little
the airplane.
Speech.
Yeah. That or the beginning.
Speech,
yeah.
Well, yeah. That little speech on the plane just takes
it's the best scene in the film.
The movie. It's the best scene in the series, let's be honest.
Yes, it is. I agree.
And like, you know, or you like, you look at all of it. You look at
The Doubt. Parables and Doubt.
The Doubt is so open to that. I'm trying to think of like,
I mean, the places... Master, he gives a huge monologue at the end that's astounding.
I'm thinking of like places inside of these movies where he is less of a presence, where he just gets a chance from whatever text he's given to give a little speech, you know, to do a little ditty. You know, like, Boogie Nights, I'm so fucking stupid. I'm a fucking idiot.
Yes.
Like, that's a speech, really. Like, it's a soliloquy or whatever you want to call it. And it's the moment from that movie that stands out as, and from his career that stands out as one of his absolute best.
Yep. Everyone remembers that scene. Yeah.
And so it's, like, I love this. When you get to this point in a Philip Seymour Hoffman movie where he's getting the chance to do a little bit of the speechifying, because it's so natural, because it feels like dialogue when he's doing it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it even happens. I mean, I just remembered the second film we did on this podcast was The Yearling, which he, you know, it's five or six scenes. Yeah, it's like a TV movie from 94. You know, no one has seen it. But he's got, it's the same thing where there's a scene where he's got four, five, six lines. He's really confronting someone. And it just, it elevates the whole movie. Like the intentionality of it, the intensity of it. For those of you who were tracking with that podcast, it's when he's yelling at his brother. And
what about what's the movie where he plays a drag queen?
Flawless. Ugh.
So that scene that, you know, everyone loves in Flawless, even that little mini speech where he's like, as long as you get down on those brick brothers' knees and suck dick, we're sisters together, or whatever, you know, I don't remember, but that's the line, you know, and it comes in this sort of little speech about how, like, you know, it's just this perfect little speech that he really nails, and it's the same thing as it always is, or, you know, always is with Phil in these movies.
Yeah.
Well, I have to bring up, too, because we talked a little about this before, about the last part of your documentary, which was Al Gore and George Bush. And now we're in an election here. It's all happening while it's happening.
Yeah.
How are you? Are you devoted? Are politics your life?
You know, it's funny because after I did that film, it's not funny, it's interesting. After I did that film, I became kind of obsessed with it.
Mm-hmm.
Not obsessed with it, but like anybody, I was really interested in what was going on and reading as much as I could and taking in as much as I could. And I'm still like that in a way, but it is a lot now. I mean, there's so much coming at you all the time. And I think a lot of people are feeling this way. Mm-hmm. You know, you're just tired because there's a lot coming at you all the time and not a lot of it that means anything. And I think that's just kind of true. I don't even think that's dangerous to say anymore. I just think that's kind of just, but you know what I mean?
People have made
I don't even think it like hurts anybody's feelings anymore to say that. You know what I mean? I think it's just true, you know? And so you are, everyone I think is kind of waiting for something or someone to say something that hasn't been said yet or that needs to be said or that is going to go against what's obviously happening, which is just a lot of news. You know, a lot of stuff, a lot of words, a lot of talking, a lot of shows, a lot of, you know, there's a lot of stuff.
That seemed to skirt the issue?
That doesn't, that hasn't, you know, changed, you know.
If there's something you would want to see change.
It's the same political,
in this world
the same political games are being played now that were played the last time.
I'm sure
nothing's
from the
changed
beginning.
In that way. So you kind of go like, well, if nothing's changed, then is anything going to change, you know?
Yeah.
I'm feeling a little bit of that, but I care deeply. I think that's why.
Is there an issue that, I mean, that is in your head that you would like to see change in?
The political process. Absolutely. The political process, the political discourse is just tiring. It's like, you just don't believe anybody. Mm-hmm. I mean, you don't. I mean, it's hard to.
Mm-hmm.
And I know there's a lot of smart, good-meaning people that are behind, you know, who are working for us in government. I know there are, you know. I met some of them. But when you see them or when it's on over the news or over the media, it's very hard to take people seriously after a while because nothing seems to land.
Do you see them acting, politicians?
I don't know. I probably. Yeah. But the political, that... My thing, political, where you start to see something real happen. And I think it's been a long time since we've seen that in any consistent level. Yeah, once in a while we see something. You know, once in a while someone says something or comes up with something or writes something and we read it. But anybody's in the high-profile environment or in their high-profile arena politically is part of a discourse that I think needs to change. Mm-hmm. I think everybody knows that. I don't think that's news. And I think would be at my... the top of my priority. Yeah.
I do want to close with Ryan Gosling did this interview several years ago. I think it was around the time this film came out. And so I'll read the questions and I'll read Ryan Gosling's answers as well.
Make sure you read it in Ryan Gosling's voice.
Okay, I'll try. So you're in virtually every frame of this film and spend a lot of time working with Paul Giamatti and Philip Seymour Hoffman. Can you compare working with the two of them? First of all, they're two of my heroes, so it was terrifying just on a base level. It was terrifying. They have very different styles. I wouldn't want to comment on them because I don't want to cheapen it with my opinion of it. Suffice it to say that they're just incredible to watch, and I learned a lot from working with them. The interviewer asks, is it the theory that if you run against someone faster than you, then you run faster working with those guys? I don't know about that, but I know that, like, for instance, watching Phil work was something that I needed to see. I feel like I didn't realize that I was getting as lazy as I was getting until I watched Phil work, because he puts it all on the line every single take. There's not a take that he lets slide. I needed to see that. Is your own perceived laziness then a part of having made several movies and having stardom invading on all the prep that you might have done as a hungrier actor? Well, like a lot of people say something about, like, Phil, that he's good in everything, in every movie, that no matter what the movie is, like, he's always good. But I don't think that people realize how much an actor has to fight in order to create enough space for themselves in order to do that kind of work. That can be perceived as difficult, but it's the reason why they're able to be so effective every time, because they know the conditions that they need to work in order to be at their best. Out of all the actors in this film, which one made you the most nervous to work with? Phil. Why him? Have you met Phil Hoffman? That's That is sponsored by One County Film, an independent film company telling stories with authentic characters and unique settings. You can rent our debut feature film, Palace, on Amazon right now. That's That is produced by me, Timothy Mark Davis, and edited by Ryan Arnst. Our show music was composed and edited by Jessica Ray Huber, and our graphic was designed by Drew Hannigan. You can connect with One County Film on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook, all at One County Film. You can connect with me on Twitter at Timothy Mark DAV, Timothy Mark Dav, and Instagram at Timothy Mark Davis. Tim, where can the people find you if you'd like to be found, or would you prefer to not be found after today's conversation?
Absolutely not.
Fair enough. Thank you for listening to That's That. Please remember to subscribe so you don't miss an episode. Rate and review on Apple Podcasts. It will help the podcast get out there to more PSH lovers. We'll see you next time with an in-depth look into the 1992 Steve Martin comedy, Leap of Faith, starring Steve Martin, Deborah Winger, Liam Neeson, Meatloaf, what? And Philip Seymour Hoffman. The IMDb logline for the film is as follows. Fake faith healer Jonas Nightingale is stranded in a small town where he finds he can't fool all of the people all of the time. The film is currently streaming on CBS All Access, which is a Prime video channel. What?
So it's The Rainmaker?
Yes, it is.
Christ. Write an original story.
I know. They rehash that story all the time. But the film is streaming on CBS All Access, which is a Prime video channel. I'll be doing the 7-day free trial for this. So please check it out and join us for a deep dive. My guests will be dear friends and aspiring faith healers, Joel D'Souza and Matt Wright. Tim, before we leave, I need the guest to quote Adam Sandler from Punch Drunk Love in a line he says to Dean Trumbull, played by Phil. And the line is, "I'd say that's that, mattress man."
I'd say that's that, mattress man.
That's That, everybody.